listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Hi, book lovers. This is Danny. Thank you for listening to Words and Nerds, where we take the writing but never ourselves too seriously. I have some really exciting reviews. This is from Danny5469642. That is not me. I promise I didn't write a review for myself. What a delightful podcast. I enjoyed the conversation and wanted to immediately buy the book of the author talked about, even though it's not my usual genre. It's so fun to hear about how the book came together and their goals and inspiration. The hosts ask very thoughtful questions. Highly recommend. Thank you, Danny. Thanks Academy says, I love a good conversation, and this is exactly that. Informative, yet not too formal. A great listen for those who love to read books and those who love to write them. And Pirate Egg says, I really enjoy this show. Currently on Ep 4 and loving every minute of it. Totally bookworm approved. Thank you, Pirate Egg, and what an interesting name. Lil Rock Pixie 13 says, this is such a comfortable, chatty podcast. It feels like a casual conversation between friends more than an interview, and the hosts ask such great questions. Also, I'm so glad I finally know how to pronounce James Fahey's name correctly. I had the same problem, Lil Rock Pixie 13. A Samaru says, for book lovers and writers, wonderful to hear the authors give insight, taking us deeper into the story and the process of creating our stories. And as an American, I love the accents. So thank you so much for those amazing, incredible reviews. Today we welcome Stephen Herrick, Australian author and poet of novels and verse novels for children and young adults, as well as author of e-books documenting his adventures cycling around the world. His verse novel, The Simple Gift, was shortlisted in 2001 for the New South Wales Premier's Literary Award and was on the New South Wales HSC list. It was also shortlisted on the Children's Book Council of Australia. His latest novel for children, Bleak Boy and Hunter, Stand Out in the Rain, was also shortlisted for the Children's Book Council of Australia. Welcome, Stephen.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast today. Like I was saying pre-interview, I've actually taught The Simple Gift a number of years, and upon reading it again, I was like, I need to bring this back into the classroom because it has been a few years.
Right. Thank you.
What I find absolutely fascinating about The Simple Gift, and we will give The Simple Gift a bit of time. Despite the economy of words, nothing is lost. I actually read it again when I was going on a bit of a road trip a few days ago, and I was just sitting there going, the characters and stories are so well drawn and complex. And you usually find that in novels, but we find that in a verse novel, which I just found so fascinating. How do you tell a story with depth and complexity using less words and being really economical with your words?
It's something I always try to achieve. I don't always achieve it, obviously. I guess the first answer is I have a very good editor. I've always had very good editors who understand what I'm trying to achieve and help me with that. So, you know, I should pay homage to them, firstly. Secondly, I guess the writers who have influenced me have been writers who cherish the economic, I guess. So people like Raymond Carver. Strangely, people like Bruce Springsteen. If you listen to Bruce Springsteen's folk albums, so the albums where he's just with the guitar, not with his band, they are some of the best examples of simple monologues of economy and tone, which I find just astonishing. And he's really one of the biggest influences I've had.
That's really interesting. It's not what I expected either.
No. And people, when they think of Bruce Springsteen, they think of Born in the USA and all that sort of stadium rock stuff, which, you know, I'm not really a big fan of, I've got to say. But there's a few of his, as I say, folk albums, one called The Ghost of Tom Joad, which is taken from the Steinbeck Grapes of Wrath novel, and another called Nebraska, where it's just basically men, usually men, talking about something in their lives that is important to them in the song. And I found those two albums hugely influential. And so The Simple Gift is really about three characters coming together and forming their own community and telling us about what they think of the world and their immediate lives. So for those who don't know it, the simple gift is basically about a 16-year-old boy called Billy who leaves home because his father is violent, and Billy goes and lives in a disused train carriage in a town called Benderat, which is really a combination of Ballarat and Bendigo, and I put them together to get the worst name for a town known. and Billy stays in this disused train carriage, and he meets an old man, also called Bill, or he calls him Old Bill, who is a bit of a drunk and a bit of a bum, I guess. And those two become friends. And Billy also meets a girl from a private school in the area called Caitlin. And Billy and Caitlin become friends. And it really tells the story of their three lives and how they connect and how they form their own community. And the beauty of the verse novel, getting back to the format, is that in most books, most novels, it is either first-person narrator or third-person narrator. In The Simple Gift, it is multiple first-person narrators. So Billy tells us what he thinks in the first person, Caitlin tells us what she thinks, and old Bill tells us. So sometimes the same scene is reflected upon in three ways, because we all have a different view of what's just happened in our lives. And so I like to look at it from different perspectives. So the verse novel format allows me to tread, I hope, lightly through that quagmire, if you like, of three different perspectives.
No, I think it really worked well. And you really got a sense of each of the characters through it, which is still, you know, obviously poetry does that, but in a novel, it was just such a different feel. And it's so accessible too for a number of different readers. And so when I was teaching it, you know, you had really high achievers being able to access it in a different way compared to other students who might not have engaged with many novels in their lives, and them still being able to access it and appreciate it and study it. So it's a text that has a range of complexities that can be studied.
Yeah, I've been really fortunate. It's been on the New South Wales HSC for over 10 years now in different categories. And as you say, it's meant that some of the advanced English students have read it because they have to, but also some of the standard English students have read it. And I've had, when I've visited schools to talk about The Simple Gift, I've lost count of the number of times when big buffy blokes have come up to me, there's no other way to describe them, I'm afraid, and, you know, started talking to me about how much they enjoyed the book.
Yeah, it kind of, when you talk about those kind of boys, and I can picture them, I teach them, they could probably connect to Billy because he's a bit of a rebel, you know, he's had a tough life, and they can probably relate to that character, which they're probably not used to in classic literature, etc.
Yeah. And what I like about it is that they can relate to Billy, but they can also relate to this old man who most of us would pass in the street and call a bum. But once we learn the backstory of old Bill, people feel real sympathy and empathy with him, I hope. And I think it's because, again, it's the format. I'm not sure if I even call these poems. What I call them interior monologues. Mm-hmm. So what they are basically is Billy reflecting on something he has just seen or done and telling us about it, not in necessarily in his own words spoken aloud, but in his own thoughts. And so they're kind of interior conversations that each of the characters have with themselves.
Yeah, I like that, the interior monologue. I've never thought of it that way.
Yeah, it's kind of like stream of consciousness without the heaviness of James Joyce, if you like.
We've got a new English HSC syllabus starting this year for Year 11, and I was thinking it could be used very well with a reading to write, because we're teaching students how to compose through reading. And so I thought, usually beginning writers or young writers, they tend to overwrite. And so I thought using The Simple Gift as an example of how you can be so economical with words and yet still create characters with such empathy and such a complex story, it can be done.
And I think it's tremendous because it also teaches them about perspective. You know, so the multiple narrator perspective is something that is really easy to do in a verse novel. There's a verse novel I've written called Cold Skin, which tells the story of the death, of the murder of a 16-year-old girl in a small country town in New South Wales. And so that story is told through seven characters who all know something about what has happened and that their response to what has happened. And to think of trying to tell a story from seven perspectives seems daunting if it's in prose, but strangely enough, in a verse novel, it seems to work well.
Yeah, I thought it worked in Pukialera. I don't think there's quite seven, but Pukialera is not my boyfriend. There were quite a few perspectives from there, and it seemed to work in the verse novel, whereas I think in a traditional novel, you'd probably get a bit lost.
Yeah, and it allows every character to have a voice and to have, I guess, a tone.
Which is interesting, isn't it? Because usually we hear from maybe one, maybe two, maybe three perspectives, but no one else.
And that's right. And so the only other way you can convey other characters is through dialogue and action. That's why I can do it through dialogue, action and thought.
Now, I found in the novel A Simple Gift too, the kindness of humans is a common theme because you don't shy away from dealing with difficult issues. But Billy meets Ernie, he meets Old Bill and the librarian, and they help him believe in the kindness of humanity. And he says, there are men like Ernie and there are other men like my dad. And I like how you don't shy away from the difficult topics for kids, which is important, but you balance it with hope and love.
I really like Billy in that despite what he's been through in his backstory, he's a fairly positive character. And the theme, if you like, of the book is the gifts that we give as individuals. So Billy throughout the book, well, all the three main characters throughout the book give physical gifts. Billy, when he first meets Old Bill, gives him the cigarettes he stole from his dad. But what else he gives is what I would call spiritual gifts. He gives Old Bill time and company and friendship. And each of the characters do that. Old Bill gives Bill, later on in the story, I don't want to provide too many spoilers, but he gives him something quite large as a gift, something physically large as a gift. But he also gives him a sense of being almost like a surrogate father to Billy. And so I wanted to explore that thing of what is important in our lives and how do we convey our humanity. And I think we do it by what we give. And they can be both physical gifts, but much more important, the spiritual gifts of friendship and understanding and tolerance. And that's how you create a just and fair society. And I think all my books look at that. From that perspective, how characters create community and how they create justice in that community.
I love that idea of the spiritual gift. I don't think we do it often enough, or we don't deliberately do it often enough. And the gift of seeing someone beyond their appearances or who you may think they may be is also really present in the novel. And Billy says, I don't know what she sees in me. I hope it's someone to talk to, someone to look in the eye, knowing they'll look back. How important is this today in a world of smartphones, you know, being present and just wanting someone to listen to you and hear you and look at you?
Yeah. I think it's vitally important. And it's that time factor. And I always think that we're a strange society in that we give Australian of the Year Awards and Australia Day Awards to people who are often elevated in society because of their job. And yet the real heroes of our society are people who do the little things, the nurses, the teachers, the people. I always tell the story of this old Greek, I think they were Greek, I hope I'm not misrepresenting them, I think they would have died by now, but it was about 20 or more years ago. They were an old couple, and old married couple, and they won the lottery. And so they suddenly became incredibly wealthy. And what they did with the money was they set up a soup kitchen near Central Station in Sydney and spent the next 10 years doling out soup and comfort to the homeless. Now, those people should be Australian of the Year every year for the next 20 years, as far as I'm concerned, or people like them. And yet we don't hear about them enough. And I think it is the little things that we do that are important.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. It's funny because I was thinking about that when I was reading in Pukialera Is Not My Boyfriend. And one of my favourite parts of the verse novel was right at the beginning where the kids are asked what they want to be. And Alex says, I want to be a dad. Everyone else is saying they want to be a vet or a truck driver or a fireman. And I thought this was such a refreshing perspective because in Australia we are so defined by what we do as a job rather than what actually makes a significant difference in the world, such as being a parent or opening those soup kitchens. And it's not something that's as celebrated as, you know, for example, a promotion at work.
I know, and I find that sad. I mean, I always regard my biggest role in life is having been, or having still been, a father of two young men. And it's certainly the role that's given me the most joy in my life. And yet, it's true. If people ask me what I did, I wouldn't say, well, I'm a dad. I'd like to, but they think I was an idiot.
But, you know, maybe we need to do more of it.
We do. And you know, I constructed most of my, I was very fortunate because I make a living as a writer, that I could construct most of my social life around my children when they were growing up. So, you know, my wife and I would always be home at 3 o'clock when the boys got home so we could play cricket in the backyard or soccer in the backyard. And those were the most important moments of my life, because I was allowed, because of my occupation, to actually have as much time as I did with the boys.
And that's how you're actually making a difference in the world. You know, bringing up two young men who are kind and good humans, that's making a bigger difference in the world than, you know, clocking in at work every day, isn't it?
I think so. And that's where people who deal with children every day, you know, i.e. teachers, obviously, are so vital. And yet they're not the most highly paid people in our society. Getting back to my books, the issue of Pooky O'Leary is not my boyfriend is really about that whole issue of doing good, in that this group of children, of 11-year-olds, decide, one of the boys decides one day to be overtly nice for a week and to convince his friends to be really, really nice for a week. And it kind of changes the whole dynamic of the school. And I really like playing with that idea. And I do it in a lot of my books. I've got another verse novel for children called Tom Jones Saves the World. And it is, you know, very obviously about, how do you save the world? Well, you save it one person at a time.
Yeah, absolutely. You save it with the people in your corner and being a great teacher or a great parent and changing it in that way. And I think if we saw, you know, life more like that, maybe we could improve the world. And that's why reading is so important for our young people.
Yes, and the sense of community. And it's why, if I can get political for a minute, it'll only be a minute. It's why when people like Peter Dutton call out African gangs, in inverted commas, they are doing a despicable action, because what they are doing is trying to divide a community. They're not trying to unite us. They're just dog whistling. And that is incredibly harmful, not only to the African community that they're dog whistling, but also because of the whole community. It splits us in two, and it should never do that. It should be looking to unite our communities.
And isn't that what news thrives on these days? Like, I barely even watch the news anymore because it just gives me too much anxiety. But the news is so divisive. You know, it's either socioeconomically divisive, or it's about religion and culture, or it is exactly what you say. They just want to continue to divide us because it must sell papers or get us to watch the TV.
Yeah, and it's very sad, I'm afraid. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Billy states early on, I love this place. I love the flow of cold water over rocks. And I found a lot in Australian poetry in particular, it uses nature to restore themselves. And with your latest ebooks that you document your cycling adventures across the world, which, can I say, look amazing, is nature a place where you get to restore yourself as well as your characters?
I guess there's two answers to that. I'll answer it firstly in relation to my fiction, my verse novels for children and young adults, in that I start writing my books, particularly the verse novels for teenagers, with one character in mind and one location. I always go to that location as being somewhere where I feel comfortable. And if I know I'm comfortable there, then I think, you know, I'll be able to set a story there. So The Simple Gift is, as I said, set in a disused train carriage in Benderat. And when I was 16, I left home and I lived in a disused train carriage in Ballarat for a little while. And I remember how much I loved sleeping there. It was better than some of the other places I slept in. So I wanted to set the story there. The other book I mentioned recently, Cold Skin, which was about the murder of a 16-year-old girl, is set in Lithgow, because my son and I would always go to Lithgow to play soccer every Saturday. And I got to like and admire that community there, and I wanted to set a novel there. You know, it's a bit sad that I killed somebody there. it was an interesting place to set a novel. So, yes, nature means a lot to me, but mainly because I need to understand the location where I'm setting my books. Location is the first character in my books, and then there is a human character involved. But to answer the question in relation to my cycling books, I wanted to just experiment by writing a different book. And so I thought, what do I like doing? Well, I like travel and I like riding my bicycle. So I thought I'd combine the two and ride my bicycle across France in, I think it was 2012. And I also wanted to explore the burgeoning new form of publishing, which is self-publishing through Amazon. So I thought I'd write a book about my cycle trip. And to my surprise, it actually sold a lot better than I thought it would. And I enjoyed doing it because all I did was ride a bike and eat lots of food to compensate riding the bike. And so I told my wife about how much I enjoyed and how much food I ate. And she decided she wanted to come with me for the next one. So we've done that every year for the last 6 years, I think it is. And the trips have been getting further and further and longer in terms of time every year.
I mean, I've seen the places on your blog, the French Mediterranean, Norway, Paris, Bohemia, Thailand, Germany, Netherlands, Slovakia. Where next?
Well, we just got back from Japan, so we rode in Japan for 2 months. I think the best trip was probably riding from Marseille, which is on the French Mediterranean, to Norway. So that was over 4,000 kilometres.
Wow.
And that's
incredible.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And I've been to Holland, my family, some of them still live in Holland, and the culture of riding a bicycle is so different than being in Sydney. It's just mind-blowing, isn't it? How did you find the difference between cycling in Australia to cycling somewhere in Holland where they're so, you know, used to it and they have the culture for it?
Yeah, it's another world, and it's really quite sad, you know, in that my wife only cycles overseas because she's too scared to cycle most of the time here. I'm a fanatic, so I'm willing to put myself at risk. But we have to change in that it's not about cycling. It's about how do you want to design your cities and design your countryside? Do you want to design it for 2 tons of metal, which is a car, or do you want to design it for humans? And surely we should be trying to take back our cities so that they are for us, for people, not for cars. It always astonishes me that a car rules everything, that most of the car journeys in Australia, and they've done research on this, most of the car journeys are between 3 and 4 kilometres. They're to the shops or to take the children to school, all distances which could be done really easily on a bicycle if we had correct infrastructure. They're the sort of journeys that are done in the Netherlands or in Scandinavia on a bicycle. And when you walk in a town like we stayed in Groningen, which is a town in the north of the Netherlands, where cars aren't even allowed in the city. And when you walk through that city, it's astonishing because it's so quiet. It's so beautiful. It's so human.
Yeah, and when you go there, it makes sense, right? I mean, my dad, he used to live in Holland and he grew up there and he used to tell me about it and I couldn't picture it. But when I went there and saw the thousands of bicycles and just saw how easily people went from place to place and how much they embraced that culture, it made sense.
Oh, it's astonishing. It's just, you know, everyone needs to, and I wish we could all afford to do it, but everyone needs to go there for a lesson in how you design a city. And there is no excuse for it. You can't say, oh, well, the Netherlands is flat. Yes, the Netherlands is flat. It also snows for, you know, 3 months of the year. That doesn't stop them riding a bike.
It's also Norway, freezing.
Norway is not flat. Let me tell you, it's only mountains in Norway. Scandinavia is not totally flat. It's just about having the will to do it and creating appropriate infrastructure where when you see women and children on a bicycle, you know you are in a civilized society. When you see men in Lycra, like myself, the only ones being on a bike, you know you're in a backward society.
Mm.
And that's the best way of judging, as far as I'm concerned.
Anyway. Yeah, no, there's certainly a lack of respect for cyclists, I think, in our society, which is terrifying.
Well, there's a lack of respect for humans, for human-centred transport. There's an unbelievable respect for cars, which kill us. You know, if terrorists killed as many people as cars killed, boy, we'd be screaming blue murder. But cars kill hundreds and hundreds of Australians every year, and we just call it an accident. It's never an accident. It's poor infrastructure or a mistake by a motorist, sadly.
And like you say, once you go there, you have such a different understanding, and then you come back here and you're like, wow, it doesn't make sense.
it's sad, and I hope one day we'll change.
It's a big job.
I write cycling articles for The Guardian, and I write pretty well the same article every 6 months about the need for improved infrastructure and more money given to public transport. Public transport being trains and buses and cycling and pedestrians and walking, those sorts of things. Mm. Not to the car. It astonishes me that we think we can park a vehicle, and we all do, park a vehicle in a city street, which takes up so much space, and just leave it there for hours on end. And what it does is it prevents cyclists from riding on that section of the road. It prevents thousands, potentially thousands of cyclists from riding on that section of the road just so five people can leave their cars there without paying anything. That's madness. That doesn't make sense to me.
No, you're absolutely right. I can see you're passionate about it. Maybe you need to get into politics next. You need to make the changes.
Well, I'm starting on you know, my pet.
Maybe that's your new career. Now, you've talked about self-publishing, and you've also obviously had books traditionally published. What have you found to be the greatest challenges or differences? Everyone is so interested in people's publishing journey, and it's not very often we talk to someone who's done both. You know, people usually either go the traditional way, or, you know, they're dead set on being indie. How did your journeys go doing both?
Look, I love doing both, and I'm going to keep doing both. I love my traditional publishing journey because it involves people who love books at every stage. The publisher loves the book. The editor in particular, as I mentioned at the start of this interview, the editor is someone who never gets enough credit for what they do. It's a dirty little secret that we writers act like we created the book. We just came up with the story and the characters and the dialogue, and then the editor honed our writing to make it seem like we could actually write correctly. And I'm at the moment copy editing my next book, and I'm constantly astonished at what my editor can find that is a problem in my script and needs to be fixed, and she can fix it so easily. Well, she can suggest how I can fix it so easily, I should say. So that's what I love about traditional publishing. What I love about independent or self-publishing is how quick and easy it can be. So I ride my bike across Europe. I come home. I write the book in maybe 3 months. I edit it myself. So it's never as well edited, I've got to say. And I can publish it in 24 hours on Amazon. And I can charge a tenth of the price and yet make the same amount of money. Because of the technology of ebooks. So that is a concern for the traditional publishing industry, I'm afraid. My ebooks sell for, you know, about $3.99, $4.99, and yet I still make as much as my 1995 children's books. So
that's crazy, isn't it?
It's very, I mean, it's because, as I mentioned earlier, the traditional publishing avenue was full of experts who really do value add to the product. In the ebook world, it's really just me writing a book and me editing and me designing the cover, me doing everything. And so you'll find if you download any self-published ebook, it's not as well written because it doesn't have the skills of an editor. No matter how good the writer is, it's not as well written, unfortunately. And some of them are just bloody awful.
Yeah, I think that's with self-publishing, you still have to try and find, you know, what has been really well written and really well thought out. So I guess that's the challenge of reading self-published work too.
Yeah, I mean, the beauty of it, though, is you can always download a sample. So you can always download the first chapter and you'll very quickly, and I've downloaded lots of first chapters of ebooks, and I've only bought maybe four in total because they're so badly written. But the ones I have bought are great, except I'd like to get my editor onto them so they could be even better. but the other thing is I am astonished how many they sell. and you suddenly have a world market. So my cycling ebooks, most of the sales, about 60% of the sales are in the UK, 30% are in the USA, and the rest are throughout the world, including Australia. So I've now got a market which I never had with my children's and YA books. They were published in America, but only one of them was published in the UK. But suddenly I'm, you know, an international author in inverted commas, simply because of Amazon and you know, like publishers.
And how do you market a self-published book for your cycling? Because they're quite different, obviously, to what you've published before.
Yeah, look, I don't do a lot, to be honest. Amazon kind of, or, you know, the publisher does it for you by putting in the correct keywords. And, you know, customers who bought this also like this. Mm-hmm. And so all those strange links that, you know, we get sold nonstop, because my books are relatively successful, they pop up in front of people's eyes. Someone writes in, if you write cycling in France in Google, cycling in France ebook in Google, it's likely one of my books will come up in the top 10.
And I guess being $3 or $2.99 or whatever they are, I mean, it's not high risk, is it, for a consumer to go, oh, yeah, that looks all right.
Yeah. And so it's been an interesting journey. And, you know, the great thing is that I get to go to Europe for 3 months of the year to ride my bike and take notes to write a book about.
Oh, it's incredible.
I can't complain, can I?
No, you've done that very well. What's next? Is it this year you're going again?
This year, sorry, we're going back to do the first book again. So that was across France from the Atlantic Ocean to Switzerland. But that won't be for a book because I've already done that. But my wife, that was the only one my wife didn't go on. And then it's probably to cycle around Greece, which I'll probably turn into an ebook. So we'll see.
Sounds wonderful.
I'm still busy writing my Japan ebook, so that will be the next one that comes out.
I saw the photos on the blog. They look incredible.
Yeah, it's a beautiful country. And, you know, cycling is the best way to see a country because you go into places where you wouldn't normally go in a car. You'd zip past and going between, you know, Rome and Florence. You just look at the Italian countryside. Well, riding between Florence and Rome is going to take 2 weeks and you're going to see every bit of the countryside and it's a delight.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I don't cycle, but I do a lot of walking when I go overseas and I've just found the most incredible places just by walking and discovering rather than, like you say, just hitting the tourist spots, which annoy me to no end because there are so many people. So I prefer to just walk and find and discover. And sometimes you don't discover anything except a cool cafe, but sometimes you discover some incredible things.
Yeah, and people, the locals seem to take you under their wing because you're going so slow. You know, they think of you as, you know, someone who is investing in their country emotionally a bit more, I think.
I agree. I'd much rather immerse myself in a culture than just go and see the three things that you're meant to see because the tourist agent tells you to. You talked about your process of writing earlier about one location and one character. Mm. What then is your process of writing? Do you plan out the story from beginning to end? I know some authors, they just then write the end and know how they're going to end it and then keep going. Do you let your characters drive some of the stories? Is it the same process for every book?
It does vary, but usually I don't actually know where the book's going, so I don't plot out a story. I think I'm very different than a lot of my author friends who I've talked to about this. They often have a storyboard, so they pretty well know where they're going. As I say, I get the location, I get a character, or usually it's two or three characters, and I've often got a theme in mind, and so I just explore that theme. What's the best example? Perhaps one, I'll talk about my newest book, which will come out this year, called The Bogan Mondrian. And I wanted to explore the biggest issue, I think, in Australian society today, which is domestic violence. And the wholesale murder of so many women. And it's a very difficult subject to explore in a fiction book, but I did want to at least attempt it. So I chose a location. I chose my neighbour's house. I hope he'll forgive me, but they're very rich and they've got a very big house, and I wanted my main character to be quite wealthy. So I used their house. About it, they've okayed it.
You have to give them a signed copy, and
I certainly will. Yeah, and I wanted to explore it from the perspective of two teenagers: one, the daughter of the man who is violent, and another is a boy who comes from the wrong side of the tracks. So again, it's also a class thing. A lot of my books are based on class issues, I've noticed. So the boy is working class, the girl is not so working class. And they need to, if you like, come up with a way of dealing with her violent father. And really, so I had that in mind, that topic, and I just started writing it. This is not a verse novel, this is a prose novel. And really, I just wanted to explore that. So it's a lot of conversation and action in response to the man's action.
Yeah. When will that be out? Are you still, you're still early stages of writing?
No, it's being copy edited now.
So okay.
It'll be out in, I don't know, I think it's September this year.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I do take it by stage rather than having it all mapped out. I'm with The Simple Gift is probably another good example. I just wanted to talk about generosity of spirit. And, you know, you get what you give in the world. And so Billy goes to a place where he can give things, his friendship, his time to old Bill, and he gets things in return. So it was just really a study in friendship, if you like, a study in forming your own community. And I think most of my books are about that. I don't think there's a lot of action in my books. This latest book certainly does have action as we tend to know it, as physical action, but most of my books don't have a lot of physical action. They just are people being good to each other in some way. Geez, that sounds pretty cheesy, isn't it?
I think it's important, actually, and especially in our current society, I think that is the most important thing.
We could use a bit more of it, yeah.
You've visited thousands of schools in your career. What do you like about interacting with young people?
I love their optimism. I love how positive they are, and I love how they will willingly accept an old man like me coming in and talking for 45 minutes and reading poetry to them. You know, if you think, hey, is there anything more scary than fronting up to a bunch of 15-year-old boys on a Thursday afternoon to read poetry to them? Well, in fact, it's really great fun, and I'm constantly rejuvenated by going into schools. I've been doing it now for over 25 years at least, and I visit about 100 to 150 schools a year, and I never get sick of it because of the response of the students.
You're absolutely right. I mean, as a teacher, we get caught up as adults, you know, paying the bills and being all serious. And I think being with teenagers, they just remind you about the joy in life because they just don't take things seriously and they tell silly jokes, and you kind of get a bit of that, which I think it's really fortunate.
Yeah. They give you a positive response. I was at a school, it was a boys' school in Victoria. And I was standing outside waiting before the students went in, and they were all lined up like they sometimes do in private boys' schools. They were regimented. And one boy, they didn't know that I was the poet they were going to see. And I was standing next to him, and one boy turned to his mate and he sneered and he said something like, "Poetry. What could be worse than poetry?"
Sounds like something you should put in your new book.
Well, I then wrote a poem about it called "Worse Things Than Poetry," and I listed all the things that I think could be worse than poetry to a 16-year-old boy. And I read it and tell that story, and I read it in every school, and it goes down quite well, actually. But those are the things that I love, that they're quite honest about.
Yes.
So I don't think I'll ever, well, I don't, I hope I'll never stop doing this, because it's one of the joys of my career. I'm very fortunate. For 3 months of the year, I write a book. For 6 months of the year, I visit schools throughout Australia and overseas. And for 3 months of the year, I ride my bike in Europe. So I'm blessed.
Yeah, you've nailed it, I think.
I'm very fortunate.
Thank you so much, Stephen. I'm definitely going to bring The Simple Gift back into my classroom. I think it also, and I really look forward to reading your new book about domestic violence, which is another really important topic that I think we should always be talking about in September.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You can find Stephen Herrick on www.stephenherrick.com.au, on Twitter, Stephen_Herrick, and Facebook.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.